Blog Talk Radio.
The left. I feel like I'm the last real nigga left. The left. It's like I'm on an island by myself. The left. Please don't make me slap you with the left. The left. You will fake so I'm gon' slap you with the left. The left. I feel like I'm the last real nigga left. The left. It's like I'm on an island by myself. The left. Girl, at least protect me if this shit go left. Cause I can cook a kilo by my goddamn self. In the kitchen, water whipping with the left. I don't know
what son of a bitch. What's up, everybody? Still coming at you. New studio. Last day before a little break skis we got here. For those of you who aren't familiar with Secular Talk, when it sounds like I'm stalling, it's because I'm stalling. When the entrance goes on a little too long, there's always a reason for it. So I was trying to get myself in position here, get the microphones on point. It's getting better, man, day by day. I feel like every day we're getting everything more under control, getting the camera angles better, getting the lighting better. I'm getting used to it, man. Everybody said, it was pretty much universal. Everybody yesterday was like, I really like what you did with the camera angle that day. The day before, it was crooked, it was too high, it was fucked up. I had a hot spot on my forehead, I believe is the technical term. There was light beaming on my forehead, but not much, you know, directly on my face. So I think we got a lot of the kinks worked out, man. And we'll see. You guys, obviously, Lilith can keep me updated on the sound with how it is during the live show here. I heard it was so-so yesterday, but whatever. What I did is I did a few things. I tweaked some positioning, and I actually have my favorite microphone back. So I was using the old school EV mic that I had, the black EV. I have the silvery chromey one back. I like the sound of that one better. Not sure exactly why that is, but I got a lot of stuff to get to, man. So we're gonna go ahead and jump right into it. We got a lot of clips today. It is a lot of clips. And without further ado, let's start. The Huffington Post laid out a list of some of the Republicans who might stand up to Donald Trump. So let's break it down here a little bit. They say Rand Paul, a libertarian lone wolf, says he will block Senate confirmations if Trump nominates either former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani or former UN Ambassador John Bolton to be Secretary of State. Now, we had touched on this a little bit previously. I had mentioned how much Rand Paul hates Rudy Giuliani and John Bolton because they're incredibly, incredibly hawkish, and he's so much better than the other Republicans on foreign policy. But now he's made it official, and what he said is, look, if you nominate either one of them, I'm going to block them. I'm going to block them, and I'm going to come after you, and I don't care that you're a Republican, you have an R in front of your name, and so do I. Irrelevant, I'm going to block them. So kudos to Rand Paul on that, and I happen to agree with him 100%. John Bolton is the worst of the worst of the neocons, and the neocons are pretty much all bad. So, you know, this is a guy who still defends the war in Iraq. This is a guy who wants regime change, in Iran, and he's pushing for it right now. He said the other day, yeah, we should do regime change in Iran. And Trump, at least in part, ran on a non-interventionist platform. The other half of the time, he was massively interventionist, and he said, I want to bomb the shit out of them, talking about ISIS, and he said, I want to take out their families, kill civilians in the Middle East. But the other half of the time, he said, look, let's spend on infrastructure here. You know, there's no need to do all this adventurism and this nation-building overseas. So if he nominates John Bolton to any position, as I said recently, that means that he was just talking. It was just rhetoric. During the campaign. It shows he's not serious about being a non-interventionist if John Bolton gets any pick. And Rudy Giuliani, too, to a lesser degree. But Rudy Giuliani is more, you know, hawkish, but inexperienced than just a pure hawk. You have a pure hawk for John Bolton, and that would be a disaster. All right, then we go to Lindsey Graham. They say South Carolina's Lindsey Graham has started publicly outlining places he might be willing to oppose Trump. He is against the Mexican border wall and is delivering warnings against Trump's intention to revoke legal status for undocumented immigrants brought here as children, although that would not require congressional approval. Graham, a traditional Republican foreign policy hawk, strongly disagrees with Trump's attempt to improve ties with Russia. Quote, "I'm going to be kind of a hard ass on Russia," Graham told reporters recently. "We can't sit on the sidelines and let cyber attacks be blamed on Russia. We can't sit on the sidelines and let cyber attacks blamed on Russia go unanswered." All right, now with Lindsey Graham, it's a little bit more of a mixed bag. So when he says, as we covered recently, "Hey, I'm not gonna take away the filibuster. I would vote to keep the filibuster." There, I agree with him 100%. Because if they vote to get rid of the filibuster, oh, you have a Republican House, a Republican Senate, a Republican presidency, they will go buck wild. They'll cut taxes for the rich 912 times over. They'll eliminate regulatory bodies. It'll be just an utter disaster. It would be terrible. So Lindsey Graham stepped up to the plate, and he's like, yeah, not really that big a fan of Trump, so here's what I'd do. I would make sure that the filibuster is still there. On that one, I applaud him. On it, making sure that the children of undocumented immigrants can stay in the country, I applaud him. So there's two areas where I say, okay, I'm with you, Lindsey Graham. But then when he gets on to, hey, we should be more hawkish with Russia. Now, look, he's not technically saying that. He's framing it as, there were Russian cyber attacks during the election. No evidence of that whatsoever. But make no mistake about it, that actually is a reason why he's upset with Trump and he doesn't like Trump, is that Trump has basically been more leaning in the direction of peace and negotiations with Russia as opposed to escalation. Hillary Clinton wanted escalation. She wanted a no-fly zone in Syria and a safe zone in Syria, which needlessly escalates with Russia and marches us towards World War III. So you had Donald Trump who said, how about no? How about we don't do that? And Lindsey Graham's like, no, I want to do that. I'm a hawk and I want to do that. I love war. So on that one, I agree way more with Trump than I agree with Lindsey Graham. See, again, it's a mixed bag. Some of them I agree more with Trump. Some of them I agree more with the other Republicans. And then finally here they say other senators who might defy Trump are Arizona's John McCain and Jeff Flake, Nebraska's Ben Sasse, Florida's Marco Rubio, Maine's Susan Collins, and Alaska's Lisa Murkowski. And they go on to explain that some of them are from more Democratic-leaning states. So they kind of have to buck a Republican president in order to get reelection. It would be a smart thing for them to do if they wanted to be reelected. And also, some of them have a long time before they have their next election. And so they got all the time in the world to even do stuff now. And if they mess up now, well, then down the road they could turn around and act like it didn't happen or say that was super long ago. Because some of these people, I mean, it's 2022 the next time they're up for reelection. So they got carte blanche in their mind, and they might actually stand up to Trump on a variety of things. Now, again, with Trump, it's a mixed bag. I don't know, and you don't know, exactly which direction he's going to go in because he's contradicted himself 800 times, and nobody really knows what he deep down believes and will do. So it's an open question. When he talks about draining the swamp and trying to limit lobbyists' influence, I go, oh, great. You should do that, but then Republicans might turn around and block that because they're massively, massively corrupt. And there's also been signs that he's not going to do that because he appointed so many lobbyists to his transition team. By the way, there was a story that said, oh, no, Mike Pence took over for the head of the transition team and he's going to fire all the lobbyists. When you read on in the article, what do they say? They fired one lobbyist. Trump has 4,000 positions to fill. We did a story the other day where we outlined at least a dozen lobbyists. What about the rest of them? So there's no way they're actually firing all the lobbyists. It would be probably impossible to fire all the lobbyists. So some of the things Trump is better on, some of the things the other Republicans are better on, but the most important thing of all is that filibuster. Because if that filibuster falls, the amount of damage that can be done is endless. So at least on that front, we should thank Rand Paul, because he's likely going to be on the right side of that one. In fact, I'm certain, even though he hasn't come out and said it. We should thank Rand Paul, Lindsey Graham, and potentially John McCain, too, because those are going to be the three. Well, I think all they need is three dissenting votes to keep the filibuster. So what that means is, just like under Obama, you're gonna need a 60 vote supermajority to get something done. Whereas, again, like we all thought, and it would make sense, like, what do you mean? A simple majority should get everything done. If you have 51 votes, that's it. That's all you need, right? Well, you know, it should be like that, but the Republicans decided, no, we're going to make the Democrats, when they have had control, they're going to need 60 votes to get anything done. So now that it's a Republican administration, I mean, you know how they are. It's super easy to see them going, yeah, anyway, we were just fucking around. You need 60 votes to get something done. We should only have 51. And they were going to, you know, flip back to that. But some of them are dissenting. Some of them are standing up and saying, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to keep it at 60. Because some of them don't agree with Trump. And some of them are going to buck the party. So, it's again, it's a scary time in America when it's like Lindsey Graham, who's the last hope to keep us, you know, somewhat intact. And you can't give a guy like that much power, Donald Trump, because only bad things are going to happen. But again, so the filibuster needs to stay, I would argue. But then also, there are some issues where I think Trump is better than the other Republicans. And again, it'll be interesting to see how the rest of his time in office unfolds and which direction he goes in. There are signs in both directions, and I'm going to get to more on that later in the show. Okay, now, I got more for you. Let's continue here. Let's go to Charles Krauthammer. The clippity clippity clips begin, y'all. Okay, let me set this up for you. Charles Krauthammer of Fox News went in on the Democratic Party and how broken it is. Let's watch.
Mama says we don't need a full overhaul. He's either in denial or he's trying to protect his legacy. The reason that you don't need a full overhaul is that there's no way to overhaul rubble. He's been in office for 8 years, and what he's left behind, he did okay. He won twice re-election because he's one of the great campaigners in American history. But every other election where he wasn't at the top, party was shellacked. Somebody once said of the 2010 election, the midterm, that it wasn't an election, it was a restraining order. What Obama leaves behind after 8 years is the loss of 10 senators, 14 governors, the loss of 31 state houses, and of 63 House seats. The Democrats are at the lowest ebb in the House than they have been since the 1920s. If you look at a map of the U.S., there are about 5,000 counties, of which Hillary Clinton won 300. I mean, there are. If you draw a map of the country, who went where, it is red from sea to shining sea, with these little concentrated, heavily populated pockets of Democrats. So this is real trouble, and the problem is because of the decimation of the party, they have no bench. When you talk about the vice president being the face of the party now, that tells you how decimated the party is.
Yeah, I hate to say it, but on this one, I agree with Charles Krauthammer. Now, his solutions are the wrong solutions, and nor do I think he has the best interest of the Democratic Party in mind when he speaks. Recently, he said, well, if they go in the Bernie Sanders direction and the Elizabeth Warren direction, it'll be worse off. That's total bullshit. But in terms of the current state of affairs, yeah, the party's been absolutely decimated. So Republicans have more governorships, they have more state legislatures, they have the House of Representatives, they have the Senate, and they have the presidency. I didn't know that other fact that he brought up, which is that they're the lowest they've ever been in the House of Representatives since the 1920s. Good googly moogly. So how did this happen? How could we have possibly gotten to this point? Well, there's many answers to that question. So first and foremost, the party has no infrastructure. Like, this is something the Republicans, for all their flaws, they apparently know how to dot their I's and cross their T's, because at the state level, they've been busting ass. They've been working hard. They've been setting up the ground game, the party has. They've set up the ground game so that somebody wants to run for office, you know, there's a process. Hey, you go to your local Republican state office, you talk to these people, and then they pitch on to that person, and then you get, you know, your campaign built up. So they also have more money at the state level, too. That's another aspect that people don't often bring up, but that's because while everybody's focusing, you know, partly understandably on the national level, politics at the national level, you have guys like the Koch brothers who are just dumping money in to races for you know, state legislatures. So they want to win state governments. The NRA, this is their trick, too. You think they're only focused on the national level? No, not really. They're focused on the state level, too. And when you buy the politicians at the state level, well, then you control state policy. And you control state policy, you can get whatever you want for state policy. And furthermore, to buy those politicians is significantly cheaper because you don't need as much money to run those campaigns. So the Democrats, while they've been, you know, focusing at the national level and money in politics in that sense, you have the Republicans have built up this behemoth at various state levels, and it's helped them gigantically, man. So the Democrats have no more infrastructure. And another problem is the Democrats in recent times, they've lost their central philosophy. They no longer have a central philosophy. I mean, if you spoke to a Democrat from back in the day, they probably would tell you, look, plain and simple, we're the Workers' Party. Simple as that. We look out for the working people, and we're more socially liberal. So we're more open-minded about how you live your life, and we're for the workers. Simple to the point. Now, in the Obama era and post the Obama era, there's been a contradiction in the points that they make. So on the one hand, Obama, change, we're going to change everything. Basically making almost what was a Trumpian argument of drain the swamp. Change, you know, we're going to be the outsiders who come in and fix everything. We're going to get things done. So on the one hand, it's change. But then on the other hand, it's they immediately pivot when they get power to, did I say change? I meant incremental change. So it was this big ideas kind of guy who's going to come in there and he's going to fix everything and he's the outsider and he's not corrupt and yada, yada. But then once he gets power, it's like, oh, anyway, like I was saying, let's like inch in the right direction or maybe go like a few centimeters in the right direction and then call it a day. And then you got to be realistic, got to be pragmatic. So it went from these big, bold ideas to incremental change. And then with Hillary Clinton, I mean, she was the embodiment of the collapse of this philosophy. Because then even the incremental change became cliches and platitudes about, I'm for good things and against bad things. You know, stronger together, break down the barriers. It was that. And then while at the same time, America's already great. Well, hold on, which is it? Do we need to break down the barriers because there's so many goddamn barriers, which would be a problem? Or is America already great? So there's not, like, there wasn't a central theme. If you ask Hillary Clinton, hey, why is she running? If you wanted to have that conversation or you speak to people, why do you think Hillary Clinton ran? Everybody's going to give you the same answer. She wants to be president. It's not like a grand vision for the future and, you know, hey, we got to act to do big changes for the people. It's like, well, what do you mean? She's Hillary Clinton, and this is what she wants. I mean, it's narcissism 101. It's really that hard. Look what's going on. So you got this scandal-laden candidate, which the Democrats, yeah, brush that aside, brush it under the rug, it's whatever, because the other aspect of how they win is, but the other guys are so bad. And what ends up happening is you followed them right off a cliff. So there's also the massive rightward shifts of the political spectrum. So people got just a little dose, just the tiniest dose of populism from Trump, and they were like, 100% on board with that. Hey, stop TPP. I'm going to rebuild infrastructure. He sounds like he means it. He keeps saying it on the campaign trail. And the Democrats had followed the Republican Party, the broader Republican Party, so far right that if you counted it up, there's no question that Trump brought up infrastructure spending way more than Hillary Clinton did. There's no question that he railed against TPP more than Hillary Clinton did. So the Democratic Party is in shambles. There's no central philosophy. They went from a party of big change to a party of incremental change, and they have no infrastructure. So what are you left with? You got nothing. You're left with this, you know, mild, banal argument of, I guess they're worse. What? What is that? So it's time to make big changes that are geared towards the Bernie Sanders wing of the party. Again, this is not what Charles Krauthammer would say is the solution, but he's wrong. Because you can see the enthusiasm. You can see a guy who very few people knew. Only the deepest political junkies knew who Bernie Sanders was. But he's a random senator from Vermont. He's a Jewish socialist, maybe atheist, who's about 912 years old. And he went from having no name recognition to winning 22 states and getting about 47% of the vote against a political behemoth, Hillary Clinton. Why is that? Because he resonated. Because he actually stood for something. He stood for making the country a thriving social democracy, making us catch up to the rest of the modern world, and helping people in their lives. I mean, it's that simple. When you're out there saying, hey, I want universal health care. Hey, I want to expand education. Hey, let's make the minimum wage a living wage. Hey, let's increase unionization. When you make those arguments, people go, oh, shit, I think you might care about me. I think you might actually give a shit about fixing the problems in the country and looking out for regular people. So that's the direction to go in. If they don't go in that direction, the Republicans are just going to keep winning elections. And there's already been signs that the Democrats are not going to learn their lesson. They're not going to learn their lesson. And by the way, this is why I also rejected the argument of, oh, Trump will unify the left and make us stronger and will take back, you know, we'll have a progressive wave after Trump. I said, that's not true. It's not true because look at what happened under Reagan. Reagan took power, massive right-winger, implemented whatever he wanted. The Democrats rolled over. There wasn't a progressive wave. There was no progressive wave. It didn't happen. Turns out when you elect people who are on the right, they drag the spectrum further right. There's not this magical progressive backlash. Let me ask you a question. If every time you have a right-winger elected, the spectrum gets shifted further to the right, what evidence is there that there's going to be a progressive backlash? There's not going to be a progressive backlash. They always roll over. What happened? I mean, that philosophy should apply to George W. Bush, too. George W. Bush was an insane neocon. The shit he did fucking wrecked the country. I mean, multiple wars, wars against countries that didn't attack us, set up a worldwide torture regime, you know, Guantanamo Bay, the list goes on, stagnating wages, more a deregulation of Wall Street. He did all those things under that philosophy that a far-right guy will unify the left and create a progressive backlash. Where was the progressive backlash? There wasn't a progressive backlash. The Democrats rolled over, gave George W. Bush whatever he wanted, and then elected, Obama, who's a milquetoast neoliberal, a centrist-y kind of Democrat. So it turns out when they shift the spectrum right, the Democrats follow them like the loyal bitches that they are. See, that's what you got to understand. The Democratic Party is full of weak bitches and corporate sellouts. That doesn't change based on what happens with the Republican Party. They're weak bitches and corporate sellouts. So the answer is, you know, not, hey, let's elect a crazy person and then fight the crazy person. The answer is we got to try to get the most liberal option every single time and fight all of them. Fight whether it was Hillary Clinton, fight if it's Donald Trump, fight if it's neither of them and then somebody different. You have to fight. Every day you got to wake up and fight. Every day you got to be an activist. You got to protest. You got to get involved. You got to work from the ground up. You got to rebuild that infrastructure. You have to call your congresspeople and let them know how you feel about various issues. Fuck, show up to their door. Knock, knock, knock. What's up, bitch? I got to talk to you. I mean, this is how change gets done. It's from the bottom up. It's never from the top down. So all these counterintuitive theories of, well, if a crazy person gets elected, that's cool, because then we'll just do X, Y, and Z. No, no, no. Do X, Y, and Z regardless of who gets elected. So the Democrats need to rebuild their infrastructure. They need to get progressive. They need to stop taking corporate money. There's a million and one things that they need to do. But Charles Krauthammer is right. The party is absolutely in shambles. Okay, now, let me give you one more, and then we'll take our first break. President-elect Trump actually had a few positive moments in his interview with the New York Times. This is from yesterday. On the issue of torture, this is what they say, quote, the president-elect's turnabout on the need for torture as a tool in the fight against terrorism, which he repeatedly endorsed during the campaign, was remarkable. Mr. Trump suggested he has changed his mind about the usefulness of waterboarding and other forms of torture after talking with James N. Mattis, a retired Marine Corps general who headed the United States Central Command. Quote, he said, I've never found it to be useful, Mr. Trump said, describing the general's view of torturing terrorism suspects. He added that Mr. Mattis found more value in building trust and rewarding cooperation with terror suspects. Give me a pack of cigarettes and a couple beers and I'll do better, he added. I was very impressed by that answer. Torture, Mr. Trump said, is, quote, not going to make the kind of difference that a lot of people are thinking. Donald Trump is going back on his not just argument that we should torture, repeated insistence that we should torture. I mean, I can't even tell you how many times. He never backed down from that. Like, during multiple interviews on the campaign trail, I mean, you would think he would soften it and say, well, okay, enhanced interrogation, something. No. He was like, no, we should torture. I remember the interview with Anderson Cooper. He kept saying it. He's like, yeah, no, we should torture. I would do waterboarding. I'd do worse than waterboarding. Absolutely. We should torture, quote, even if it doesn't work, he said. Basically saying, well, look, they deserve it anyway, so we might as well do it. Of course, missing the fact that the majority of people who we get, if we don't get the right people. I mean, how many times have we brought it up? And nobody else brings it up, which drives me fucking crazy, by the way. The people who we got at Guantanamo Bay, this idea that they're all Al-Qaeda and they're all horrible people, just total and utter nonsense. We cut deals. The Bush administration cut deals with warlords in Afghanistan and Pakistan and the governments of Afghanistan and Pakistan and said, hey, ship us guys who are jihadists because we just got attacked here on 9/11. So what happened? They didn't fucking ship them jihadists. They just rounded up people who they didn't like, who were their enemies, and sent them. And then come to find out later on, we're like, oh, shit, we don't have the right people. Are you kidding me? None of these people are jihadists. They admit in the torture report, they at least 20% of the people they tortured, totally innocent, did nothing wrong. So, but this is why you need due process. This is why it's so important. But Donald Trump says, no, forget that. We're going to torture, quote, even if it doesn't work. That's what he said back then. Now what's he saying? He's like, well, look, I spoke to some people who know a little bit more about the situation than me. And they say, you give me some cigarettes and give me some beer and I'll earn their trust and I'll get the answers and it'll be the right thing. That's how we can do it. It's more useful if we go about things that way. If you treat them with respect and undermine their philosophy. So some of the people who we get maybe are bad guys. And they think, well, the West, full of infidels and evil people, and they're the worst of the worst. They're scum. Well, what if you undermine that ideology? What if you treat them good? What if you treat them with respect? What if you crack them? And I mean, if they're isolated and they got nobody to talk to and they're going nuts, I mean, any human being goes nuts regardless of ideology. If you're in isolation, you're going to fucking lose it. So, but then somebody comes along and they're a nice person. You can play good cop, bad cop. There's a reason why good cop, bad cop is still a technique that you know, police departments use, because it works. Yeah, one who's the hard ass, one who's the good guy, you open up to the good guy eventually. So, and this is what the expert is saying. Hey, man, it doesn't work. John McCain was tortured. He goes, yeah, no, it doesn't work. It's a horrendous thing. It reflects poorly on our moral code. We become the bad guys that we're trying to avoid. And it's also just not useful. They won't tell you the right answer. They'll tell you anything to make you stop. I mean, that's what it is. But now Trump is saying, hey, you know what? Maybe I was wrong about that one. Oh, what? Look, man, see, this is why everybody was getting mad when Obama, for example, was like, give him a chance. Or when Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren said, here's the deal. If he tries to implement, you know, bigoted policies, if he wants to ban 1.6 billion Muslims and kick out all undocumented immigrants and do nationwide stop and frisk, we will not give a fucking inch. But if he wants to block TPP, we'll fight with him. If he wants to do an infrastructure bill, we'll get in the room with him and we'll work out a deal and we'll make it good. So when people said that, some idiots on the left were like, how dare you? That means you're legitimizing white nationalism. What? Everything he does that's bad, you're now legitimizing because you decided to do some good things with him. Okay, that makes no sense. That's cutting off your nose to spite your face. Well, but now you see there's a chance that maybe he's not the worst president ever. I mean, look, I can only go where the evidence takes me. Now, it's possible that he's just saying this, and this is, again, maybe to calm fears around the country, and then he will turn around and do torture behind the scenes. That's certainly possible, but I can only go where the evidence takes me. Right now, it's a little contradictory. He was the most pro-torture person I'd ever seen during the campaign season, and now he appears to be super reasonable, and he says, no, that's not the right way to go. The experts told me it's not, so I'm not going to do it. What's he going to do? I don't know, but I hope it's this. I hope it's this, because unlike Rush Limbaugh, remember when Rush Limbaugh said, I hope President Obama fails? Yeah, I'm not an idiot, so I don't hope that about Trump. I hope that Trump has a see the light moment and get enlightened moment on all these different policy issues. So I hope he actually blocks TPP. I hope he actually does an infrastructure bill. I hope he actually doesn't cut Medicare and Medicaid. That one looks bad, by the way, because he's appointing people who want to cut it to be the head of those programs. So, but I hope he does the right thing across the board. Of course, because I care about the country. I don't give a fuck if it's a Republican or a Democrat who does the right thing. I want them to do the goddamn right thing. So, look, if this was like a Trojan horse kind of thing, fine. Right, but rather that than him actually believe all the insane shit he said during the campaign. Most likely scenario, it's a mixed bag. Some of it he said and means, some of it he said and doesn't mean, some of it he doesn't mean at all. I don't know. It's a mixed bag, I think, for sure. But we're going to have to always go where the evidence takes us. And this is a flip-flop I can believe in. And then the final point I want to make is, during the same interview, he said, there's, quote, some connectivity between climate change and human activity. Okay. You're inching on that one, too. He's come a long way from, it's a Chinese hoax. He said that on Twitter. It's a Chinese hoax to take on manufacturing. That's what it is. Chinese hoax. Okay, no, it's not. Scientists, what, it's a conspiracy with virtually all the climate scientists in the world? Is that what it is? Chinese hoax. I'm going to pull out of the Paris Agreement on day one. He's laying the groundwork to do that, by the way. So I wouldn't put too much weight on this comment here, but it's still a step in the right direction. When he says, well, it is happening, and there's some connectivity between what people are, you know, there's some connectivity between what we do and what happens in the climate. So we'll see. And he also went back on his thing about prosecuting Hillary Clinton. He's like, I don't want to hurt them. I love that one because the right-wing blogs appear to be feigning outrage. They're like, how dare he? Broken promise, broken promise. They're looking around like, do you guys think we're mad? So it looks like an area where the right-wing can, you know, do their own little grandstanding and pretend like they're super against it when they're actually fine with Donald Trump doing that. I was curious all along how the right would react if/when Trump disagrees with them on certain issues and goes in the opposite direction. And I'm going to predict again, just like what happened under Reagan, just like what happened under Bush. Bush exploded the debt and the deficit. What's viewed as a massively, you know, wrong thing, incorrect thing, bad thing in conservative circles. But they defended it because it was Bush. Like, oh, what are you going to do? He raised the debt and the deficit. It is what it is. So when their leaders do things that they would yell at a Democrat for doing, they're like, no, get a pass. So the first thing where I've seen them not do that is on him saying, I'm not going to prosecute Hillary Clinton. But I think it's just window dressing. I don't think they're actually all that mad. So, but anyway, maybe I'm wrong about that. But either way, he's inching in the right direction on some things, and we got to be reasonable here. We got to be open-minded, and we got to say, hey, I'll take it. If you want to do flip-flops like this away from bad positions and towards good positions, okay, we'll take it. We just need to, and here's the most important part, make sure the actions match the words, because the actions and the policy goals that they push for, that's all that matters. Okay, let me take a quick break. When we come back, what do I got for you? I got a little conversation about whether or not Donald Trump is going to get a second term. Oh, boy. All right, stay right there, guys.
I'm
death you with the left, the left. You will think so, I'm gonna death you with the left, the left. I feel like I'm the last real nigga left, the left. It's like I'm on an island by myself, the left. Please don't make me snap you with the left, the left. You will think so, I'm gonna death you with the left, the left. I feel like I'm the last real nigga left, the left. It's like I'm on an island by myself, the left.
All right, we're back, y'all.
All right, a lot of stuff to get to. Let's scoot on over to our buddy David Pakman. See what he has to say about Donald Trump's likelihood of getting two terms. David Pakman from the David Pakman Show weighed in on the likelihood of a second term for Donald Trump. Let's watch.
What is the likelihood that you think that Donald Trump would be a one-term president?
I'd like to say that it's very likely. The problem is it is difficult when presidents run for re-election to defeat them. I mean, the power of incumbency, we know it exists with House and Senate seats, and it exists with presidents as well. So I think that the most likely scenario where Trump doesn't get another 4 years is that he chooses not to run for re-election. Don't you think, Pat? I mean, it's tough to knock off an incumbent president.
I'd have to agree, and a sitting president hasn't chosen not to run for re-election since LBJ in the 60s, so
exactly
it hasn't happened in a while. Yeah.
Yeah. If you put a gun to my head and force me to pick right now with the very, very limited information that we had as to whether or not Donald Trump will get a second term, I would say yes, he's going to get a second term for multiple reasons. Again, it's too early to make an actual prediction, and it would just be a guess, not even a too educated a guess at this point. But, I mean, first and foremost, the guy was underestimated every single step of the way. I mean, you know, it's what I've been saying all along. When people said, oh, he's not even going to run, then he decided to run. And then once he was running, people were like, yeah, he's not going to make it to the debates. And then he made it to the debates. And they're like, well, he's not even going to win the debates. Well, he won a debate. He's not going to win the second debate. He won the second debate. He's not going to lead in the polls. He led in the polls. He's not going to win a single primary or caucus. He won a primary. And then they just kept, he's not going to win multiple. He won multiple. He's certainly not going to be the nominee. He became the nominee. He's certainly not going to be the president. He became president. Next step, he's certainly not going to be a two-term president. So you can see it unfolding. Now, again, that logic isn't too sound because there's so many variables in play here, and there's a decent chance the economy just tanks in his time in office, maybe partly because of him, but also because of the shitty regulatory system we have. I mean, we have so many problems. We have so many fundamental flaws in the economy. The subprime mortgage bubble has been reinflated. We have student loan debt crisis on our hands. We have derivatives, which is a whole other issue. I mean, so we have a stagnating middle class wages, which is a gigantic problem, which means the middle class doesn't have the purchasing power that they used to. And when they don't have the purchasing power they used to, they have to load up on debt. And when they can't load up on debt anymore, what happens? Everything goes bust. So when there's no more, when people are not there, when there's no people to buy the goods created by the so-called captains of industry, well, then everybody gets fucked. And this is an argument that should have been made to elites all along. Like, no, you don't get it. If we don't lessen this income inequality that we have, well, then you're screwed in the long run, too. Because it's going to blow up in your face also. So that, I mean, there could be the economy could tank under him. And then if that happens, it would be hard for him to get re-election. It also depends when it happens. So if it happens later, if it happens like 2 or 3 years in, well, actually, I don't know. See, I was going to say if it happens 2 or 3 years in, that might help him more because then he gets to make the argument, I haven't even had the opportunity to address this yet, and this isn't my fault. This is from the previous administration. But then if it happens like a year in, he's actually more likely to make that argument. Hey, it ain't me. It's the guys before me. But 2 or 3 years in or 4 years in, well, then you probably have already implemented some tweaks in the economy that could have led in part to the crash. So I don't know what argument he would make. But let me just say there's a decent chance that with a crash, he gets knocked out and then somebody else gets elected. But if there's not a crash, it's more likely that he gets reelected. And I think a crash is coming. I just don't know when it's coming. So it'll be interesting to see and really fucking scary to see. And the ideas that are there when the crash happens matters. I mean, that matters so much. Because if you have somebody in there who doesn't believe in the government's role in the economy, so if you have somebody who says, oh, everything is tanking, that's nice, let's cut government spending, well, then you exacerbate it and make a recession a depression. So the philosophy that's there, this philosophy of, oh, deregulate further because the regulation was the problem, oh, that'll be opening up a whole nother can of worms, because that's what happened during the Great Depression. The initial reaction from the government was, well, why don't we just deregulate more and cut taxes more for the rich? And that'll help. So they focus more on that along with deficit reduction and cuts in public spending. Oh, well, that exacerbated it. They had to go in the other direction. So if you have somebody in there who doesn't believe in Keynesian economics, you have somebody in there who's not of the MMT school of thought, well, then, well, good googly moogly. And that might be what Trump does. Trump might go in the wrong direction when that happens. So it's yet to be seen, but I also think when it comes to campaigning, he's a superb campaigner. I mean, he had a 63% unfavorable rating, and he won the election. What does that tell you? He's out there. He's pounding the pavement, man. He did, like, an insane number of rallies, way more than Hillary Clinton, and he did them in the Rust Belt. He knew which states he had to pick off. He knew he had to break down that Democratic firewall, and he did. And he was out there nonstop, just campaigning nonstop until he was, I was going to say blue in the face, but even more orange in the face. So I think he's a great campaigner. I actually think that people underestimated his populism all along. Everybody focuses on, and for understandable reasons, they say, oh, God, he's saying this xenophobic, bigoted shit, sexist shit, racist shit. In Trump's case, I think that's true. You know, whether it's the Muslim ban, hey, ban 1.6 billion people from coming into the country, kick out 11 million undocumented immigrants, let's do nationwide stop and frisk, even though that's been proven to be discriminatory and cracks down on black people, and over 90% of the stops yield nothing, so you're just taking away minorities' Fourth Amendment rights. So people focus on that part of it, but they underplayed the effects of the I'm against trade, I want to keep your job here, I care about manufacturing, I care about, you know, these small factory towns, I care about the people, let's drain the swamp. Like, all the other stuff he said, I think, resonated a lot. And if you have a Democratic Party that doesn't realize that they have to actually care about the people, well, then, of course, he can get a second term. So it's yet to be seen, but I think it is more likely than not that he gets a second term. I'm saying that with reservations because a lot of that is contingent upon how the rest of his time in office unfolds, what he does, what happens with the economy, so on and so forth. Do-do-do-do-do, bitch. All right. All right, now we go to bad Trump. We spoke a little bit about good Trump. Now we're going to speak a little bit about bad Trump. Donald Trump spoke to the New York Times yesterday, and he pulled a classic Richard Nixon. Quote, Mr. Trump denied that his campaign had energized the so-called alt-right movement, saying he disavowed it. It's not a group I want to energize, he said. And if they are energized, I want to look into it and find out why. Now, that's the part of the his back and forth, which was positive. Because the alt-right claims, oh, we're doing this in Trump's name, and we love Donald Trump. And credit where credit is due, we came out and said, I don't like you guys. And I disavow you. I don't want to energize you. Stop. So credit where credit is due. You could argue his campaign rhetoric was sufficiently bad where it did mobilize these people, and that's a fair point to make, and I agree with that point. I think I've made that point many times. But at least he's disavowing them now, and that's better than nothing. So, there's that. But here's him pulling a classic Richard Nixon. So they explain here. Mr. Trump brushed aside questions about conflicts arising from his business dealings, declaring that the law is totally on my side. The president can't have a conflict of interest. Wait, what? So people are bringing up, and we covered this on the show yesterday, he filed like registered eight new businesses in Saudi Arabia during the campaign. What? And then not to mention there were some in Indonesia and some elsewhere. And he's got business dealings everywhere. I mean, Dubai is a golf course in Dubai. He's got a million and one things all around the world. Now, again, for a normal person, for a private citizen, you go, okay, there should be regulations on that stuff, but I guess we can allow it. That's fine. No, but he's running to be president of the United States, and he got it. He's president-elect. He's going to be president of the United States. Why is that not okay for him? Well, for obvious conflict of interest reasons. Everybody rightly went after Hillary Clinton for the Clinton Foundation because they go, hold on now, we're supposed to believe you're going to make smart, objective policy about Qatar or Saudi Arabia when they've given your foundation millions and millions of dollars. No, you're going to look the other way as they do human rights abuses, and you're going to arm them. Well, it's the same thing with Donald Trump. He can say whatever he wants to say, but he's got business interests in Saudi Arabia. He's not going to do anything to crack down on them. Why would he do that? It would threaten his own bottom line. So that's a conflict of interest. And Donald Trump himself ripped Hillary Clinton for that. And again, rightly so. But now he's guilty of the same goddamn thing. And then he turns around when he's called out about that. Hey, man, people feel a little iffy about these connections that you have. I'm going to repeat it. He says, the law is totally on my side. The president can't have a conflict of interest. So in other words, it's Richard Nixon 101. When the president does it, it's not illegal. Yeah, it is. That's kind of the whole idea of law. Nobody's above the law. That's a classic authoritarian thing to say, an authoritarian thing to believe. But most authoritarians are smart enough to not let that cat out of the bag, to let people know what their philosophy really is.
Trump's like, yeah, anyway, like I was saying, if I do it, it's not illegal. Tremendous, believe me. Let me just tell you.
Oh, this is so sad. Look, I just gave Trump credit earlier in this show because he's backpedaling on his repeated insistence on the campaign trail that we should torture. He said, yeah, look, I spoke to an expert, and the expert was like, it's not effective. Give me some beer, give me some cigarettes. Let me undermine their ideology, and I'll get better answers that way. Credit to him for that. Credit to him for saying there's some connection between human activity and climate change now. So he's acknowledging it's real, which is a step in the right direction from it's a Chinese hoax. And he's saying there's some connection. Now, he still looks like he's going to dismantle the Paris Agreement, so the praise only goes so far on that front, because your policy actually matters more than anything else, more than what you say. But still, I gave him credit earlier in the show, because on some issues, he's going, okay, let me, and slowly but surely, in a more reasonable direction. This is the opposite. Here, it is a disaster, and this kind of verifies exactly what we thought Trump was about, how he's kind of this impulsive, thin-skinned, narcissistic, authoritarian character. Well, when you just come out and say it in an interview like that, the law is totally on my side, even though it's not, and the president can't have a conflict of interest. Well, people should be very concerned about that, because on the civil liberties front, that's where I think, I mean, don't get me wrong, Obama's been a disaster, like the NSA. He beefed up NSA spying. Horrendous. And this is why we were screaming at him all along. Some partisan Democrat said, yeah, but we trust Obama with those powers. Do you trust the next guy with them? Now, I don't trust Obama with those powers. I don't trust anybody with those powers. But some partisan Democrats were like, well, look, at least it's Obama. He's a reasonable dude. He's not going to use it for crazy shit. Well, now he's passing off these powers to a guy who just said when the president does it, it's not illegal. So you don't think he's going to use the NSA for his own personal reasons? You don't think he's going to crack down on political opponents? He's already gone on multiple tweet storms against the media. He berated the media. He called the media over to berate them to their face the other day. Dude, you're the president. We got the First Amendment. We got the Constitution. That's not a dynamic that exists. You don't get to talk down to them. You're not their boss. But we have an authoritarian-leaning president who wants to crack down on the media, who says, hey, when I have conflicts of interest, they're not conflicts of interest by definition, because I'm me, I'm the president, I have power. He is going to let the power go to his head, and we need to guard against it. I'm of the Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren school of thought on Donald Trump. On issues where he's seemingly going to do the right thing, he kept hitting TPP, looks like he wants to get rid of TPP. I will stand in solidarity right alongside you, son. You want to do an infrastructure project? I'm down. So I would work with him when he's right about stuff, because that's the reasonable thing to do. But when he's wrong about stuff, not only would I not give an inch, I wouldn't give a centimeter, I wouldn't give a millimeter. And I would go to the press, and I would go after him ruthlessly and viciously and fiercely, and I'd rip his face off in areas where, not only where he's wrong, but where he also fundamentally misunderstands the American system and the Constitution. Okay. Next. Okay, let me do one more, then we'll take our final break. And then we got, don't we have a little vacation coming up here? That's right. We got Thanksgiving tomorrow. We got, we're off Friday. We'll be back on Monday. Give me some more time to do tweaks to get this perfect for you. I think I even slightly improved the camera angle today. I know, I'm such a loser for continuing to talk about this stuff, but I care. I want it to look good for you guys. I want it to be right. I want you to see your money's well spent. Okay. Oh, by the way, GoFundMe.com/secular talk. We're inching up on that goal, baby. Help me pay for this. Okay. Now, Carl Icahn. Let's talk about this guy. Carl Icahn is a well-known billionaire. He went on Fox Business to talk about Donald Trump's election, and he had an interesting theory about the media.
I think it was very unfair in the election what the media did in many cases. You can do what you want on the editorial page. You know, I write this editorial, and they put it in, they call Icahn, signed it, that's what he believes. But when you put out the news, and I tell you, that's why less and less people are really reading the news in newspapers, because you want to get everyone's opinion. Everyone wants to give their opinion in the news, and I don't think that should be done. And I think that is the problem that you have with the media in this election. I never saw it. I've been around a long time and been very involved, and I never saw it as bad as it was here. In fact, it might have helped Donald. You know, it might have been a backlash that,
absolutely,
you know, people read it, say, bull, you know, and a lot of people really, that's a reason a lot of people don't read the newspapers.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's somewhat true. So he's arguing that the media talking about Donald Trump nonstop, but even when they went after him nonstop, it may have helped him. And, I mean, he would argue perhaps just by the fact that they're going after him. That was enough where people said, oh, like the establishment is lined up against him, so something must be going on with this guy. Maybe we should vote for him. I think it's a little deeper than that. I think the fact of the matter is the way they went after him was the problem. Because they didn't. There's a way to go after Donald Trump where you expose him and you show him to be a ruthless, petty, vindictive idiot and an authoritarian monster. And you can frame it in a way where he's not Teflon Don. He tanks in the polls. We've seen him at different times tank in the polls. You need to do the right attacks against him. You need to. There are ways to go after this guy. He said so many ridiculous things. He is a silly character. So, of course, you can go after him and it can work, but the media didn't go after him in any serious way. So what did they do? Well, I'm always reminded of a few examples. So during the campaign, he said at one point, the TPP is going to rape us. He said that during a rally. The media covered that for like a few days, and they made a big deal of it. He used the word rape. How dare he? How insensitive to rape victims. Now, in some circles, that's a point where people go, oh, yes, good point. That's a minority circle, though. It's a small number of people. Because the reality is, most people are going, okay, now why not address the substance of his criticism, which is the TPP is very bad. They dodge that. They don't want to talk about the actual merits of the trade deal, because on the merits of the deal, Donald Trump is right. That's a disastrous deal. So you snub the substance. And you focus on the PC outrage angle of the story, and people start rolling their eyes, and they go, for fuck's sake, man, really? So that was one example. Another example is a story that was actually a very real story that should have been covered, but the way they covered it was the problem. So when Donald Trump was caught on the hot mic saying, I grabbed him by the pussy, every news story on that, you would hear them repeat, grab him by the pussy, 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 grab him by the pussy. But nobody really focused on the actual problem with that statement, which was the phrase after it. Quote, I don't even wait. So that means he grabs by the pussy and he doesn't wait. What is he not waiting for? What do you mean you don't wait? Well, the answer is consent. Now, he goes on to say,
well, you're a star. They let you do what you want.
But how do you know they're letting you do what you want when you just said, I don't even wait? And it turns out after, you know, what is it, over a dozen allegations now? They didn't want him to do it. He just did it because, quote, I don't even wait. He doesn't even wait. So the problem was the lack of consent, not grabbing him by the pussy. I'm team pro grab him by the pussy. Sometimes women want their pussies grabbed, but you need consent. Consent is the key. But when you focus on that part of the story, people lost the forest through the trees. They're like, oh, yeah, no, so why are they mad about it? You just said grab him by the pussy. They forgot the substance of the story that, oh, I don't even wait, it's sexual assault. So that's another example of it. The Republicans ran an ad against him where it was just him cursing for the whole ad, like different times where he was cursing. He gave a speech at CPAC, I think, and he said, fuck. But they ran the ad as if it was like a gotcha. Like, you know how adults respond to that? Yeah. And? We're adults. We're adults. He's using adult language. You're not running for president to appeal to toddlers to get a toddler's vote. They can't even vote. Now, I guess there's a small point of, oh, don't you want somebody presidential who has class? I think we're past that 1950s mentality, or even maybe it stretches as far as the 1980s. This idea of like, well, you have to talk a certain way and be a respectable person in your demeanor, and people are like, no, that smells disingenuous now. It smells fake. Because it is. So Trump came along a little rough around the edges, and people go, oh, straight shooter. Even though he's not a straight shooter, he lies nonstop. The way he's talking overrides that, where people go, oh, I sense the strength, and I sense the straight shooter way that he talks. He does stream of consciousness talking like I'm doing to you right now, as opposed to Hillary Clinton, who's on a script and break down the barriers. And am I doing my practiced robotic politician moves right? So I do think he's right. This was a backlash. I mean, there were a lot of factors that went into him getting elected. But yeah, the media piling onto him and piling onto him about the wrong things. Yeah, that's one of the reasons why he won. Look, I said it before. If I was the one who was in the mainstream media and I was covering Donald Trump, I know which things are actual scandals and which things are not scandals. And I know which things have the potential to tank him and which things won't tank him. And, you know, one of the examples of things that would take him is when he said, let's take out their families, talking about terrorists in the Middle East. So he's saying not just, hey, let's kill terrorists, saying let's kill their families too. Well, I mean, it's a horrific, disgusting thing to say, and it's the textbook definition of terrorism. You know, if I was an opponent against him, I would have ran ads calling him a terrorist, because that's what that is. I mean, that's like, again, the textbook definition of it. So there are ways to tank him. Because he has said hideous things. Bernie Sanders kept bringing up one of them, and he's right. At one point during the campaign, Trump said, when he was asked about the minimum wage, he said we need to lower wages. I would clip that out and run it nonstop. If the media did that, ran that as, you know, their outrage campaign against him, he would have lost. Because people actually care about that. People go, oh, shit, he wants to lower wages? I'm not making that much money right now. I got to keep my wages. And by the way, it looks like he is going to lower wages. Because there was Obama's executive orders that increased overtime pay. It raised the cap for overtime pay. It was only about $23,000. Obama raised it to about $47,000. So people making $40,000 or less on salary now get overtime pay time and a half. And Trump and the Republicans were like, yeah, let's cut that. So he is going to lower wages. He is going to lower wages. So, but if you focus on that, people will go, oh, I can't vote for that. He's against me. But they didn't focus on that. So there are ways to attack him where it would work, but you didn't attack him that way because for the media, the outrage meter is broken. You got to fix your outrage meter and get outraged at the right things. When a guy says, I want to pull out of the Geneva Conventions, that's what you talk about. You explain why that's a horrendous thing and why that's the underpinnings of international law and why we have civil society. I mean, you know, treat the American people with respect and dignity, and I will educate you about important facts that affect your life. Instead, they go for the quick eyeballs. grab him by the pussy, grab him by the pussy. He said the word rape. Oh, my God, let's all run for the hills. So, you know, he was so beatable, so beatable. If I ran Hillary Clinton's campaign, she would have won. If if one of the mainstream media networks, if I ran one of the mainstream media networks, Hillary would have won. By the way, again, I despise Hillary Clinton. This isn't about Hillary Clinton. My point is, when you cover Trump in the right way, when you attack him in the right way, he doesn't stand a chance because he said so many preposterous things. But they're not focusing on the things that are actually preposterous. They're focusing on the PC outrage stuff, and that's a problem. Okay. All right, let me take a break. When we come back, I got a bunch of stuff I got to do for you. Obama pardoning nonviolent drug offenders. I got a video on that. And Chris Christie goes nuts on the issue of marijuana. Stay right there, guys. We'll be right back.
All right, we're back, y'all. We are back. We are back. We are back. Bye-bye. Shout out to Zeke. Zeke was the one who tweeted me that song. He said, you got to use this as your opening song. And I heard it, and I said, yeah, that appears to be correct. I mean, it's just perfect. It's exactly like a Secular Talk entrance song. If I was a fucking professional wrestler, I would come out to that song. All right, let's give Obama some credit here for something that he deserves credit for. Huffington Post did a superb segment here where they spoke to nonviolent drug offenders who Obama has pardoned or commuted their sentences. Let's watch.
My name is Sharana Jones. I was 32 years old when I was sentenced to life in prison for a first-time nonviolent offense.
Hello, my name is Kenneth Kemp. In 1993, I was sentenced to four life sentences without the possibility of parole.
My name is Jason Hernandez. I'm from McKinney, Texas. At the age of 21, in 1998, I was sentenced to life without parole plus for nonviolent drug crime.
My name is Brittany K. Byrd, and I'm an attorney and Clemency Now campaign director. When I was a young adult, my mom was in prison. I started representing people in prison who were serving decades fundamental death sentences for nonviolent drug offenses.
Ultimately, I spent 18 years in prison until President Barack Obama granted me clemency in 2013.
I received the news on December the 18th, 2015.
May 5th of this year, President Barack Obama commuted my sentence to time served.
It was like a moment I had been waiting on for so long.
I still don't have the words to describe it. I cried like a baby.
I want to really thank President Obama for his groundbreaking clemency initiative and really encourage him to grant an unprecedented number of clemencies.
President Barack Obama, you know, I love you like a father, and I can't thank you enough for what you've done for me and my family and for all the other families that you brought their family member back home. But, you know, you got to do more. I mean, we're counting on you. Families across the United States are counting on you.
I would like to see him release as many people or give as many people as he can the hope to keep going on. And that's what clemency represents. It represents hope to so many people who have no other alternative, have no other remedies in court.
Whoever's in there, come January 20th, if they're still in there, they haven't received clemency, they're probably going to die in there. I mean, you're their last hope.
Yeah, that was awesome. That was a great segment they put together. And to actually show the faces of the people who were locked up for a really long time. Blah, 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 blah. Learn how to speak, dipshit. That was awesome. To see the faces of people who were locked up, some of them serving life sentences for nonviolent drug offenses, and now Obama has let them go. By the way, he's now... It's a record. He's done over 1,000 pardons or commutations of people who did nonviolent drug offenses. And look, these are human beings who, you know, you can say, hey, they messed up at one point in their life. Why should they still be in there? But honestly, I don't even say that because that's too harsh on them. I don't even think they messed up. In fact, I was thinking about it last night. The term nonviolent drug offender is a term that I don't like. Because it implies, like, something there. Nonviolent drug offender. Offender of what? If it's nonviolent and it's drug involved, nonviolent and drug involved, that ain't an offense. That, you know, if we're talking about how it should be, that's not an offense. You didn't hurt anybody, and you're involved with drugs in one way or another, whether you sold them or you stored them or you took them or what have you. That's not somebody who should be locked up. I mean, we should spend our resources... I'm going after real criminals. I don't know, people who do assault, people who rape people who do murder. I mean, like, obviously that's where our resources should be spent, but no. We're spending a tremendous amount of money locking up nonviolent drug offenders. I mean, what a gigantic waste. And to me, when I see stories like this, it's like, oh, the real crime is being committed by the system and by the people who are perpetuating the system. The ones who are saying, no, yes, let's take away all your freedom and lock you in a cage because you did something nonviolent with drugs. So if I was Obama, I'd give him a bunch of credit for what he's done here. But like the guy said at the end there, I'd go further. Everybody who I could, who's a nonviolent drug offender, I would free him. Because they don't deserve to be in there. It's that simple. Now, I know that you can't do that at the state level because, you know, you'd have the governors would have to get involved. But there are ways to apply pressure that I would do. You know, you just threaten some of their funding for various things. Oh, really? You don't want to sit down and make a deal and free some nonviolent drug offenders? Well, how about we take away your funding for whatever? You fill in the blank because they get a lot of federal funding to various states. Oh, they'll sit down at the table after that. Especially when your demand is, hey, release nonviolent drug offenders. Like, really, we can't even start and have a conversation with people for marijuana? I mean, we have it legal in multiple states now. So people were locked up, locked in cages for years for doing something that is now legal in Washington State, Colorado. People just go to the store and get some weed and then go home. You could get locked up for years for shit like that. So I give credit to President Obama, and he deserves a hell of a lot of credit on this. Again, I would go further. Not only would I free as many people as I can who are nonviolent drug offenders, I would change the schedule of marijuana away from Schedule 1. I would do whatever I could, executive order or otherwise, to make it so that you can mitigate the damage of the next administration. Because it looks like with Jeff Sessions wanting to be Attorney General, Trump picked him for Attorney General. You know, you could see all the progress on weed go away just like that. I mean, it's a gross thing to think about, but it's true. Right now, federal law overrides state law. That's the way our Constitution works. And under federal law, it's illegal to smoke marijuana, to have marijuana, all these things are illegal. So this guy said good people don't smoke marijuana. He's massively anti-drug. He's the Attorney General. He can crack down on those states in a second. He just needs the green light from the president, and that's that. So I don't want to lose all this progress we made. So we have to make as much progress as possible. Obama needs to do as much as possible, and then we need to draw a line for if/when they come to crack down on it again, giant uproar. Now, thankfully, it feels like we've already hit that tipping point because California just legalized recreational marijuana in the last election. Now so many states have it legalized. So you hope we're at the tipping point where people would rise up if there's a crackdown on it, but the work's not done. There's still a lot of hard work to do. Obama's getting the ball rolling here, and I give him a lot of credit, but we really need to go further. Okay, now, speaking of marijuana, Chris Christie. Chris Christie did an Ask the Governor radio segment on a New Jersey radio show, and he went off on the idea of marijuana legalization.
It seems like from what I'm hearing that you're the only obstacle in the way right now in the state of New Jersey to actually go forth and legalize recreational marijuana. You know that Senator Sweeney and a bunch of the guys went to Colorado and they came back and they all had high hopes regarding it. They said how much money it could generate yearly in tax revenue, which would totally have to wipe out the gas tax. The revenue.
It's not even close. Mike, let me stop you for a second. Are you high right now? Because if you're telling me that tax on recreational marijuana would wipe out the gas tax. The gas tax raises $1.2 billion a year. At what level are you taxing recreational marijuana where you're going to generate $1.2 billion in tax revenue from recreational marijuana?
Heard of that, Governor? I should have said maybe adding that along with the gas tax.
Listen, that to me, legalization of marijuana for tax purposes, and that's the only way people justify it, because you can't justify it any other way, it's blood money. That's what it is to me. I have watched too many kids start their addiction with alcohol and marijuana, and then move on to much more serious drugs. And every study shows that marijuana is a gateway drug. And studies have shown that marijuana causes damage.
Almost everything he said there was false. The only thing he's right about is the tax revenue situation. So in Colorado, I think it was $70 million in taxes in 1 year, but maybe that's going up now, so I don't know. And I don't know what the situation is going to be like in California because they just legalized recreational marijuana, so they're going to bring in a lot of money from that. So, yeah, it's true that it wouldn't, you know, wipe out the need for the gas tax in New Jersey. Or actually, I don't – sorry, I'm thinking out loud here. I didn't think they had a gas tax in New Jersey. But anyway, I digress. Let me try that again. I'm in New York right next to New Jersey. I've been in New Jersey a lot, and I didn't think they had a gas tax there. But anyway, yeah, that was a tremendous amount of bullshit. It's 2016, and this guy is still making arguments like that. The only thing that makes me happy about this was looking at the like to dislike ratio on that video, because they uploaded it to YouTube, and there was literally one like, and it was like 700 and something dislikes, or actually, no, that could be wrong, I think it was 700 and something views, one like, and maybe 30 something dislikes. One person liked it, everybody was like, boo, boo, fuck you, boo. Yeah, Chris, if blood money is when you keep it illegal, that's where there's going to be blood money, because if you keep marijuana illegal, who has a monopoly on the market? The drug cartels. The drug cartels, you know, the people who literally in Mexico have beheaded people. I mean, you want to give these people more money, more power? Because that's what you're doing if you have marijuana illegal. If you legalize it, tax it, and regulate it, all of a sudden, you know, they get shut down. They're not going to be able to compete with big corporations. So it was the same thing with prohibition, by the way, alcohol prohibition. When you had it illegal, the mafia got really powerful because they filled the void in the marketplace. So they got more powerful, crime went up, and they were vicious and brutal. Same thing happening with the drug cartels today. So the thing that you're concerned about, all blood money if you legalize it for tax purposes. No, there's blood money right now because it's illegal. If you legalize it, crime drops. So he's got the argument exactly backwards. And then I like how he makes up, well, legalizing weed for taxes is the only justification people give. What? No, they don't. That's one of the reasons we give, but there's like 18 other ones. I mean, for example, how about all the studies that show it's actually beneficial for you in many ways? How many ailments does marijuana help with? Have you seen that list? It's preposterous. It just keeps going on and on. It helps so many people with so many different things. And who is he to tell people, like, no, I don't think it helps you? They're like, no, Chris, this helps me. This is a guy who didn't allow the oil, I don't know how to pronounce it, cannabidiol, whatever it is, the oil that doesn't even get people high. But they use it, and they've used it for kids to stop seizures. It stops these kids who have epileptic seizures. It stops them from seizing. He didn't allow that in New Jersey.
Because marijuana is bad.
Well, hold on, Chris, that doesn't even get them high, and it's for kids to stop seizures.
I don't care.
So we're talking about a really stupid dude here, man. I mean, even given all the evidence of how good it is and how much it helps, he doesn't care. And also, when he says every study shows it's a gateway drug, what? No, it does not. He keeps making shit up. Every study shows it's a gateway drug. What kind of a joke is that? And furthermore, you want to talk about an argument to legalize marijuana? How about freedom? You know, these are the same guys, and Chris Christie loves to make this argument. He's made it in other contexts.
You know, the Constitution is what it's all about, and these goddamn Democrats and liberals are taking away our freedoms.
You just said, you totally sidestepped the issue of, hey, maybe you should have the freedom and the right to put in your body whatever you want to put in your body as long as you're not hurting anybody else. Totally sidesteps it.
Well, I'm not for that freedom. I'm for other freedoms that are ones that I approve of. But I disapprove of that one. So, yeah.
And then also, come on, the gigantic hypocrisy, which is this guy's, well, oh, he's so concerned about your health, which is why he wants to ban marijuana and not have it for recreational purposes. Chris, I think you have your own health issues to worry about here. Marijuana is to some people what fucking, you know, cake and McDonald's is to you. I know I'm being an asshole here, but he's a big dude. He likes to eat. Now, he likes to eat to the point where it's detrimental to his health. In all seriousness, it is what it is, man. He can live his life however he wants to live his life. He's not physically hurting anybody else, so even though he's doing something that's bad for him, by all means. But he wants to take that right away from you. And by the way, the marijuana you smoke isn't as bad for you as the fucking gluttony he does is for him. So there's also a little bit of a false equivalence I'm giving off here. I don't want to do that. The marijuana is less bad for you than what he's doing with how much he's eating and all the shit he's eating. So, but either way, look, I'm not here to judge him. I want him to have that freedom in a fucking free country. He doesn't want you to have that freedom, though. His vice is okay. Your vice is not okay. So spare me, Chris. Your arguments suck. The only thing you were right about was the amount of tax revenue. Yeah, it wouldn't bring in as much as that kid thought it would bring in. But that's only one of endless arguments as to why it should be legalized. I see nothing compelling in the other direction. There's nothing compelling as to why it should remain illegal. Okay. All right, let me do one or two more here real quick. GOP consultant Paris Dennard and journalist I can't talk today, man. That's a little bit of a problem when you have a fucking talk show. GOP consultant Paris Dennard and journalist Charles Kaiser went on CNN to discuss Donald Trump. Now, Kaiser, you're going to see here, he's the white guy. He's a liberal, and he's going to light into Trump. And then Paris is he's a black conservative. But watch what Kaiser says and how Brooke Baldwin, the CNN host, reacts.
I want to give him a little advice for the future if he does not want to stimulate the alt-right. First thing, he should never retweet someone with the name White Genocide who lists his address as Jew America. That's what he did in February. He should never ask his supporters again to give the Nazi salute, which he did at a rally in March. That's not a good idea. In July, I think it was a mistake.
Wait, when did
he
say that?
In March, he asked his supporters to raise and pledge their support to his candidacy and promise to vote for him.
Okay.
There's plenty of video of that. Find that. And then, of course, in July, he retweeted an image of his opponent with the six-pointed Jewish star on it. I thought that was a mistake. But we have bigger problems here. Also in July, you know, he selected as his vice president the most homophobic man in American public life, a person who believes that gay people actually do not have the right to exist. And then, you know, if you don't want to support the alt-right, don't choose as a White House counselor, a man who uses the word nigger, whose wife says that he did not want his daughters to go to a school with too many Jews, and don't choose as an attorney general a man who calls the NAACP an un-American organization, and who we learned in The Guardian today went so far as to prosecute
people. Hang on a second. I appreciate you going through all of this, but please don't use the N-word on my show.
I'm sorry. Well, I never use the N-word except when I'm quoting someone who has been appointed by the president to serve in the Oval Office, since this is such a disgusting moment in our history.
I think Senator Sessions is an honorable man. I think that he's doing a great job, and I know that this particular HBCUs, he's been a strong proponent of them. Many of them come from the South, and I know he represents them, and so I believe that he's going to be someone who's going to be confirmed, and we can go back and look at everyone's history. I'm sure the person sitting next to me on this program has said some things that he would regret, but we have to look forward.
I think it's shameful that
we
any African-American would support this man to be attorney general.
Sir, you
shameful.
Don't know why. You know what? I don't question your allegiance to the people that you support. I will tell you why I support Mr. Trump, who's the president-elect, because I think he's going to do good things for this country, and particularly good things for my community.
How do you feel when
President
Trump...
All right, gentlemen, we're done. I appreciate both your voices.
You.
I am still... The more I've sat here and listened to the fact that somebody used the N-word on this show, it is not okay. It is not okay, Charles Kaiser. I respect you. I enjoy having you on as a guest, but not okay.
I'm going to do my best to not be a dick in this segment, though it might be a little bit difficult. So understand what went down there. So again, the white guy, his name is Charles Kaiser, and he's as liberal as it gets. He wrote a book about a brave family escaping Nazi Germany or something like that. So, and you heard from his opinions there. He's massively liberal. In fact, he said some things that I thought were even unfair to Trump when Trump said, "Oh, give us your, raise your hand and give us a pledge that you're going to vote for us." And he said, "Oh, he asked them to give the Nazi salute." He didn't ask them to give the Nazi salute. He said, "Raise your hand and give a pledge." Now, you could say the pledge in and of itself is bad enough, but it's unfair and mischaracterized it to say, "Oh, he asked for people to give the Nazi salute." So, but he's a big time liberal. You can tell by the shit he said. And so he goes through a bunch of the stuff there, because Trump disavowed this alt-right movement. To his credit, he did that, because the alt-right, they had a conference, and they were just neo-Nazis. They were literally giving the Nazi salute, and they were saying, "Hail victory," which is Sieg Heil. So Trump denounces them. So this guy goes out there and says, "Okay, that's good, but, I mean, dude, come on, you made your bed, and now you're sleeping in it. You retweeted a white genocide account with fake statistics about black people killing white people. You did that during the campaign. You selected Mike Pence as your VP, an extreme Christian supremacist." I mean, his track record is abysmal on this stuff. It's insane. Jeff Sessions, for Attorney General. Guys, Jeff Sessions went after a white civil rights attorney and called him a traitor to his race. What? White civil rights attorney, traitor to his race. He made a joke about the KKK. He was like, "I thought they were good guys until I found out that some of them smoke marijuana." He's just kind of overtly sympathetic. When you see, go after a white civil rights attorney for being a traitor to his race, there's no question. I mean, you are deeply, deeply bigoted. So, horrible appointment. He also said good people don't smoke marijuana, but that's a different topic. So Trump picks this guy, and his argument is, look, man, if you really want us to think you're not racist, not bigoted, and you're and, you know, you really disagree with this alt-right, don't appoint all these shitty people and don't retweet white genocide accounts and don't appoint Steve Bannon, who has a history of using anti-Semitic headlines and stuff. He's saying don't do all that. Now, in the middle of that conversation, he used the N-word. He used it because in context he was talking about that Steve Bannon uses it. And he's saying this is why you shouldn't appoint him. He's a fucking loathsome character and he says shit like this. Fucking, you know, the wheels came off the conversation. Brooke Wall was like, "Excuse me? Did you just use that word on my program?" He didn't come on there and start calling people the N-word. He used it to describe and explain Steve Bannon uses it, and he should be nowhere near power. But no, Brooke Baldwin flips it. The black conservative guest flips it. "I'm offended that you used that word." Now, at the end there, you see Brooke Baldwin, she gets like kind of visibly emotional. She's like, "That's not okay. You used that word on my show." This, again, this is classic missing the forest through the trees thinking. Because instead of being mad at the black conservative guest who is defending Jeff Sessions' appointment to Attorney General, when Jeff Sessions said a white civil rights attorney was a traitor to his race, he's sympathetic to the KKK. He says good people don't smoke marijuana. He's an insanely backwards character. Instead of being mad at the black conservative for supporting bigots, she goes, the white liberal used the N-word in context to explain somebody else who says it. Therefore, he's the bad guy. And I'm not going to hold the person accountable who needs to be held accountable, who is who are the fucking people who are defending Jeff Sessions. So this is the problem, man. This is PC liberal outrage that misses all substance. You miss the entire substance of the conversation. The guy got a pass for being okay with Jeff Sessions as Attorney General. But the guy who used the N-word to explain somebody else using it in context, not out of any vitriol or hater because he was saying it, that guy's the enemy. So the liberal on the panel, he's the problem. The conservative who wants to back Jeff fucking Sessions, who's going to roll the clock back on civil rights even further and is going to ignore hate crimes because he's responsible as Attorney General to prosecute hate crimes, that guy's cool. This reminds me of the story we did yesterday. Jake Tapper was off from his show. Sorry, I know I look weird here scratching my chin. Jake Tapper, whose name sounds like a porn star, I know. CNN host, he was off from his show, and there was a banner at the bottom of the screen. So the guest host was talking, and the banner at the bottom of the screen said, alt-right leader questions if Jews are people. Now, people were tweeting at Jake Tapper saying, this is your show, I hope you're proud. Now, Jake Tapper was like, I agree, that's totally unacceptable, and I'm not okay with that. Hold on. So they're mad about the framing of the banner and the fact that the banner's on CNN. When the banner is just describing what Richard Spencer, the alt-right leader, was saying, why would you not focus your anger at fucking Richard Spencer for saying it? Why aren't you mad at the alt-right people for expressing that sentiment? No, they have to be mad at the probably liberal person who made the banner that says, alt-right leader questions if Jews are human. Like, they're mad at the banner, and they're mad at Jake Tapper, and Jake Tapper's mad at his staff. How dare you accurately say what the alt-right and Richard Spencer were saying? But this is what I'm talking about. The left is eating itself with its PC outrage. Be mad at fucking Richard Spencer for being anti-Semitic, for making grotesque, disgusting arguments. Don't get mad at the liberals who are relaying the message of Richard Spencer, who are saying, this is what he's saying. I can't believe you accurately quoted him and used something offensive in that. Guys, it looks like we're gonna lose in 4 years again to Donald Trump. That's what it looks like. I'm just being honest with you. That's what it looks like. Because this is, it's a joke. Like, I look at this and I'm like, seriously? It's like Brooke Baldwin just, it's like a balloon floated in the corner. She's like, balloon, follow the balloon. Oh, white guy said the N-word, but he was describing somebody else saying it and talking about how it's bad. I don't care, use the N-word. Shut down the conversation. Now I agree with the black conservative. Spare me. I can't take this PC outrage nonsense. Okay. I'm out of time, guys. I got two more stories. We'll do them on Monday. Everybody, enjoy your Thanksgiving. Hope you get a break. Much love. And hope you guys love the new studio. We're going to keep tweaking till everything's perfect. Mwah!